Welcome to The Sci Guys, the show where we talk about the crazy, weird, and wonderful stories from the science world. I'm Corey, and as always, I'm joined by my co-hosts, Jem and Luke Cutford.
Hello.
Howdy.
This week, we're talking about the language of love.
Ooh.
But first,
sexting.
No.
Oh.
No.
I look forward to finally learning.
Your wife craves it.
Rebecca specifically requested this episode.
Oh my God, is she a patron?
But first, it's time for a Spotify update. So, on Spotify, this is pretty cool. So, this is maybe a little bit outdated. I checked this a couple weeks ago when I started writing this episode. But still, we have had over 720,000 people start listening to the episode.
Our
episodes. We've got over 40,000 listeners and 26,000 followers. 26,600 followers. So by the next time we do a Spotify update, why don't we try and push to 30 maybe?
Oh, yeah.
Go on, all the way to 30.
Yeah? So why not 30 in a month, right? So it's not Halloween. What's Halloween but love today? When it comes out, what is it?
Valentine's
Day.
That's it. Halloween for love. That's an interesting way of putting it.
It's holiday, but
it's a Christmas
love
for love. Or
it's Halloween for love, isn't it? Because it's like you're
because you go dressed right as lovey things.
Yeah,
yeah.
So by let's say next month, the 14th of March, the 13th and 14th of March, let's try and get to 30,000 followers on Spotify. So if you're not following us on Spotify, go ahead and do it right now. Also, I would like just to say, check out our merch. It's pretty cool. But answer a question in our comments right now on YouTube. What is your love language? Let us know.
English?
No. Shall we start the actual episode? Yeah?
Yes, let's start the episode, please.
Yeah. Okay. So you might have heard of the love languages, the five love languages. These were became very popular in the 90s and have persisted nowadays. I mean, now even you'll hear people say, oh, my love language is cereal. Or something for a fun tweet.
Oh,
or perhaps a
yes.
TikTok. Mm-hmm. Yeah?
Yes.
I feel like it replaced spirit animal when spirit animal became taboo.
Oh, yeah. Spirit animal is culturally appropriative.
Yes.
Now.
Yes.
Yeah. So, I mean, yeah, right? I feel like, and it's interesting that you bring that up because I did have spirit animal later on in this episode because it kind of ties in to what I'm talking about with love languages. So, love languages, you may think they're a scientific thing. No science involved in the creation of them whatsoever.
What?
We'll get into how they were made. We'll get into what they are. But what do you know about love languages up front?
So, you got ones like physical touch, like act of service, like giving a gift, like words of affirmation, and... Oh, God, come on. I've got to get it. I've
so
got to get it.
This is all new to me.
Can you give me a little clue? Oh, giving people your time.
Quality time. Oh. Whoa.
Wow.
Luke, you not only got them all right, you got like the names right. So
because I'm a
I don't know
they
were actually defined love languages.
So there's the five love languages. Oh. Quality time, physical touch, acts of service, giving and receiving gifts, and words of affirmation. That was incredible, Luke.
Thank you.
Well done. The five love languages were created by Gary Chapman, who was born January 10th, 1938. He's 84 years old, and as far as I'm aware, not dead. So, hey, Gary, if you're listening, good on you.
That's a nice word of affirmation.
No. No. No.
Well,
still kicking.
It's an affirmative that he's not dead.
Yeah, that's true.
So, he studied anthropology and so a bit of linguistics as well. He's a PhD in adult education, and here's a quote from him from a New York Times interview in 2011. As a senior in high school, I had a strong sense that God wanted me in some kind of ministry. Oh, I forgot to mention, he is like a pastor or a father or whatever it is when you're a God man, but like in a church and like working
priest?
There.
Oh, a bit higher than a priest.
Curate?
He's a God. He's a God dude. He's a Christian God dude. All right. I think a pastor.
Yeah.
Okay.
Christian God dude.
Yeah.
Right? We'll just call him that.
Pastor.
No.
Fettuccine, spaghetti.
There were only two things I knew in a Christian framework that I could do. One would be the pastor of a church. The other would be a missionary. I didn't particularly like snakes, so I decided that I should probably be a pastor. So when he was a young pastor in North Carolina, he was doing basically marriage classes for people. So basically, you know, if you you got to think about it this way, a lot of places in the US, a church is like the center of a community, right? So you go to your pastor for a lot of different things. So like you could go to a pastor for counseling in some way, right? So people would go to him for marriage counseling, essentially, and like that would be the way that they get that. So you had he didn't have necessarily experience in sort of like studying marriage or and whatnot, like studying that sort of counseling. He had, I mean, more practical experience from people coming in and him like working through their problems with them, right? So that's where his experience lies. And apparently he went through dozens of years of notes, which that's very old. Like this book was published, I think, in 1992. So the book was published in 1992. He was born in 1938. Anyone want to do some quick maths?
No.
54. Okay.
Oh, yeah. More than I thought.
He was 54 when he published the book. And he obviously, you're a pastor from very young. So he'd been working at this for a good while. And so here's a quote. This is from Vice in 2019. Chapman deliberately kept his book's Christian message subtle so that more people would read it. Some people tell me they didn't know I was a Christian until they get to the end of the book, which is fine, said Chapman. Towards the end of the book, I say something to the effect of, what I've given you is information, I can't give you motivation, but I'll tell you how I got my motivation, and I have a paragraph about my relationship with God, and how that changed my relationship with people. So that's kind of the background on Gary Chapman. The book was published in 1992, so it seems to be under two different names. The first one, the one that I'm going to be using, and the one that I knew under, which is The Five Love Languages, How to Express Heartfelt Commitment to Your Mate, and the other one, The Five Love Languages, The Secret to Love That Lasts. Apparently they were both published in 1992, and I don't really know. I know that the Heartfelt Commitment to Your Mate one, that's the one that I'm going for. That's the one that I've actually got and have had a little flick through. So it sold 8,500 copies in the first year, which is four times what the publishers expected. And then the year after that, it sold 17,000 copies. And then 2 years later, it sold over 100,000 copies at 137,000. Wow. Yeah. This book blew up. I mean, to the point where, I mean, I'm surprised you've never heard of love language. I mean, you've heard of love languages.
I've heard of love languages, but I didn't know there were actually like defined languages.
Well, that's what's that's even more incredible, that it's permeated culture so much that you're like, yeah, love languages. Yeah.
What? Sushi is my love language.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You know it from that context.
Well, it kind of comes from sushi is my love language. Is that
the first odd thing for a vegan to say?
Yeah. It's kind of like, it's kind of memed itself through social media, and it's also kind of like it's kind of like horoscopes, that kind of thing, a way of people discussing their preferences and what makes them different to other people.
It's personality tests.
Yeah,
the same so it's really similar, I think, to the Myers-Briggs type indicator, which we've done an episode on. You can find that in the description, perhaps in a little playlist on pseudoscience and other such similar things.
Spoilers for that episode and this episode, the fact that it's in the pseudoscience playlist.
Wow. Is it really a spoiler? I already started off by saying this guy is a pastor with no scientific training whatsoever,
and yet he turned out to discover the deepest scientific truth anyone ever discovered.
Well, I feel like I honestly feel like you're getting a bit ahead of yourself here. There's going to be a few surprises in here for you. So, a little quote from the New York Times interview from 2011 again. I asked Dr. Chapman, who holds a PhD in adult education, if he was ever concerned that his views lacked academic underpinnings. Most people are not going to read an academic book on marriage, he said. The normal person wants to know, what's going to help me? I think that's quite interesting. Because it is true to an extent. You know, if you fill a book with, here are academic things, to an extent, people will think, yes, I am with the science. This is good. No, you're Joe Rogan loving types. They'll eat that up. But generally, people don't necessarily. People just want to, with horoscopes, right? People don't care. They just want to understand themselves and describe themselves. They want to be able to put themselves in a lovely, neat little box.
Yeah,
people
and they
love
want
little
practical
boxes.
Advice as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
They don't necessarily care why or how. They just want the advice.
Well, okay, let's go on a quick little rant here that I've been meaning to go on for a little while.
Oh, here we go.
Look, practical advice and psychology, people will do this thing where they read a psychology paper, and the paper says, we found that in this cohort, you know, people, like X thing happened when Y. And so then people will like go on TikTok and say, did you know that psychology says that if you do X, then Y? It's like, no. Like, they'll extrapolate things out of it that aren't quite there. So, like, I mean,
a lot of the time, if you read the conclusion of the paper they're citing, it says, do not draw this conclusion.
Yeah, yeah. They'll say, like, you can't, like, basically, you can't then say that, you can't use this as a trick or a hack. Like, usually, if you see someone on TikTok or if you see someone on, like, any platform, really, I keep on going on to TikTok. And that's not because the platform itself is an issue or anyone on the platform is an issue. There is misinformation on every platform, but unfortunately, TikTok prioritizes really short content and doesn't provide any way to cite your sources. YouTube has descriptions. Twitter, you could do threads. Instagram, you could put whatever you want in a long caption. TikTok, you got nothing, buddy.
You can put the link in a pinned comment, but then the person has to like manually copy the link and put it in their Safari.
It's unwieldy, right? And same with Instagram. You could, you know, it's difficult to get it there, but like there's, Instagram is more about, it's not less about like, you know, sort of like video content and more about just images, although
not
that's
yet.
Changing. That's changing and it's moving to be more like TikTok, in which case I assume it's going to follow that same trend. But my point is that TikTok basically prioritizes unsubstantiated, bite-sized claims, which is exactly where these people that love psychology misinformation.
Okay.
No.
It doesn't prioritize unsubstantiated claims.
It
just doesn't have any way of you proving your claim, which means that unsubstantiated claims get through the net.
So it inherently, in its design, encourages it. Not intentionally, but inherently so, as a byproduct of the construction of the platform. Okay. I'm not saying that the makers of TikTok want misinformation to spread. Absolutely not. I'm just saying in the way that they've made their platform, it results in misinformation being incredibly easy to spread. Like, it's so difficult. Like, I will see a TikTok. I saw one actually earlier today about someone saying that this Bible is actually the real Bible. The Bible that you know has actually had the name of God taken out of it X number of times. And I saw that, and I don't know anything about, you know.
Is it the Apocrypha?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. I don't know anything really. I don't know much about the Bible. I don't know much about theology, all that sort of stuff. And so I heard that and I was like, oh, that's interesting. And then immediately it was a stitch. And this person that I do follow and who I do very much trust because he cites the sources. He's like, he studies this. He's as far as being able to trust a creator goes, he is on the more trustworthy end.
Mm.
I wouldn't take everything he says absolutely at face value, but I recognize that he is an expert on this, and the things that he says when he cites the sources generally seem to be trustworthy.
That's exactly how Champ and I view you.
You shouldn't. not an expert. I cite my sources. Big dummy. I got one out of the three. So this guy was stitched that video and was like, well, here's why this isn't true. And I caught myself and I was like, damn. I would have, if that was just the TikTok and I was just scrolling past, I didn't even like I wasn't going to watch the full TikTok until I saw the guy that I recognized.
Yeah.
I would have just gone away with that little bit of information sitting in the back of my head.
Yeah. It's
crazy.
Not because I was like, oh wow, this is really interesting information. Just because I was like, okay.
Oh, cool.
It's not important to me, so I'm not going to check it.
Yeah.
I just take it like a little bit at face value. And I'm someone, you know this, I'm someone that like almost obsessively tries to check and validate all of that kind of stuff. Like, I don't just see a TikTok and take it for granted. Generally, it's science-based stuff. And when it's not science-based stuff, it's really out of my realm of sort of just out of my knowledge base. So I'm much more likely to take that stuff at face value just because I don't have enough knowledge to be able to know to know immediately if something seems a bit off or, you know, anything like that. And even if I don't know something's off, I'll usually try and check it anyway. But the point is that misinformation can spread really easily on there. And when we bring it back to this sort of psychology thing, you have a lot of these people that just will say, oh, here's a psychological hack. Here's a psychology hack to trick yourself into doing this. If you do a Superman pose in the shower, it'll make you feel more confident because this study showed that this pose is this. And they don't understand that you can't necessarily extrapolate one study out into all of humanity with this one particular, like, it just, it doesn't work.
Remember when someone told the Conservative Party about that Superman thing?
Don't.
This is great. Set of photos where the Conservative Party have been told by, I don't know, maybe behavioral or like some kind of psychologist that like if you stand looking powerful, then people will think you're powerful. And there's just like there's like every member of the Conservative Party standing in a like overly powerful pose. It is so funny. Yeah, there we go. Look at these. Look at these. Oh my powerful, God.
Triangle that's legs.
It. They look like more. If you get like an action man and you just like
just put the legs apart. The legs apart. So that's not a power pose so much as it is
missionary.
Look at this George Osborne one. What's going on? Oh, yeah. He looks like he's squatting in the woods for a pee.
So my point is, like, my little rant here is that when people like sometimes have papers backing themselves up, those papers don't necessarily back up what they're saying. You can't necessarily take a single paper and say this is a psychological hack, because that's not how those papers work.
What's super interesting about this as well is that we've now got, like, especially TikTok, and it's actually especially TikTok, where like people, the bar to becoming a creator is so much lower now. Whereas when I started being a YouTuber, you had to buy a DSLR, you had to buy a lens. You could do it on an iMac, yeah, or something, with a webcam. But then as the platform progressed, you generally needed to get softboxes for it to look nice. Or at least that was the route it took. And now everyone's just on their phone, sit by a window, whatever. What's really interesting about this is that this still misinformation stuff, passing misinformation around, this has been going on for the entirety of human history, as we've been able to talk. It's just that it's not been on the record and it's not been amplified.
Yeah.
And now the spread of information by some random person without having checked it happens so quickly, and it's on the record, so we can spot it and go, actually, this is wrong. But it's nothing has fundamentally changed about what we're doing.
Yeah.
We're flawed in our information processing and like how we share information with each other without checking it.
Yeah. And it's, I mean, there's... Honestly, combat, this is something I do constantly, like try to combat misinformation, and it's tough, and it's especially tough trying to recognize it in myself. Like, whenever I'm lazy about information, sometimes I'm lazy about information, I'm acutely aware of it, and I'm like, oh God, it's so much effort. It's like, it's so tiring, like having to look into things to really, because, okay, I have a right wing person coming to me and saying, oh, did you know that actually the Black Lives Matter people stole money from Black Lives Matter Foundation and that's why they bought that house? And I see other people on the left saying, well, actually, she wrote a book and that's where she got her money from. And people say the same thing about Bernie Sanders, where, oh, Bernie Sanders is a hypocrite. He's so rich. He's exploiting people. And Bernie Sanders wrote a book and was maybe like he inherited a house as well, or something, like stuff like that. It's tiring having to think about actually having to look into those claims and find unbiased sources to either refute or support them. It takes time, and so I don't always have that time, and it's very bloody tiring having to like constantly be aware of what's going on.
Yeah.
And this is something that I've noticed as well. People try and use a shortcut on TikTok. If there's an expert talking about their field, people will tag Hank Green and say, Hank Green, is this true? Especially if it's especially if the person is not white or a woman.
Yeah.
Which is an issue of itself. So one, we shouldn't necessarily just trust people. Like a person is fallible. Data is also fallible. But you can't necessarily trust a person to give you good information, right? Like,
but it's Hank Green.
Exactly. It's Hank Green.
He would never tell an untruth.
But people will tag Hank Green, who is more or less in a lot of fields just some guy, when an expert in their field, like wearing a lab coat in their lab, talking about a thing that they have specifically studied.
You can't check that they're an expert in their field. I suppose you could try and do the work, but it's easier to just tag.
You could very easily check if someone's an expert in their field by looking at their name on TikTok, because they'll have their name on TikTok, searching it on a database for studies and seeing if they actually have published papers in their field.
Yeah, but that's not normal people behavior, Corey.
I know. All I'm saying is that it's entirely possible, but people tag Hank Green.
Hank Green can do that for us.
Where's Hank Green's papers?
That's what Hank Green does. That's his function in this society.
Hank Green is the white man like that validates all other people to make sure that they're right, despite the fact that he hasn't studied. And like, this is no shade to Hank Green whatsoever. Like, what Hank Green does is very valuable. It just is, unfortunately, it results, and he does try and combat it to some degree. Unfortunately, it results in people just like just not believing some experts until Hank Green is like verified. Oh,
I think that they don't believe the expert, and then Hank Green helps them believe the expert. It's not because Hank Green verifies things that they don't believe.
No.
They will now never trust anybody until Hank Green.
It's not
Green
that they don't trust it. It's just, I'm not saying that they mistrust it specifically. Yeah. I'm saying that they don't have an active level of trust. It's interesting because they have a healthy level of skepticism, but unfortunately, the only way for that skepticism to be, I don't know, subdued or removed is for Hank Green to give it his seal of approval.
Yeah, but that's the same thing as, I think actually that's potentially quite a good thing when you're on a platform like TikTok. Because it's like, before, it's not like we haven't previously had like authority figures, like the news, like a specific news outlet to tell us whether, like to kind of pull down our level of distrust a little bit. So it's like, oh, if this outlet's saying it, it's potentially slightly more credible. And Hank Green is just—he's just the Guardian or the BBC or like CNN or something. He's just a guy now, and he's doing it for us.
I'm saying that it is better than nothing.
Yes, yeah.
It is not good.
Okay.
Right. It is. It could be much better. Right. Like,
it's very effective though.
If your skepticism starts and ends at whether Hank Green has said it's okay,
it does.
It
noble people.
Yeah, like it's really worrying. It genuinely is worrying.
What are we going to do when Hank Green dies? No, we need to start investing in keeping him
Hank
alive.
Green Jr.?
Otherwise, we're not going to be able to trust anything.
But that's my point. That like your understanding of whether something is valid or not, starting and ending at Hank Green's seal of approval, is a problem because it means you're unable to discern whether something is truthful or not.
You're starting to sound like the conspiracy theorists now. Your level of skepticism starts and ends at the mainstream media.
No, then. And if your level of skepticism does start and end at the mainstream media, then look a little bit more into it because everyone is fallible, right?
Yeah.
And again, the people, this isn't the issue. People will trust, so let's talk about public health crises, for example. In a public health crisis, people will trust a doctor, for example, I don't know.
Chris Whitty.
No. People will trust a
doctor. Who?
People will trust a doctor, like a gynecologist.
Yeah.
And pretend as though they know more than an epidemiologist on the topic of a public health crisis, right?
I see.
And because the person is a doctor, that's an authority figure.
Ah. Yeah.
And they'll say, well, they're an authority on this because they're a doctor. No, they're not. They study vaginas. This disease is not a vagina disease. Why would they know more than an epidemiologist about the spread of this disease?
Because they're confirming my belief, Corey.
Exactly. It's just
and they're smart at something.
And this is the issue.
Cite your sources. My source is this vagina doctor.
But like seriously, like if there's a mass problem in vaginas, then sure, I'll listen to the best gynecologist in the world. But if the best gynecologist in the world is disagreeing with epidemiologists on the spread of a disease that has got nothing to do with vaginas, then I'll probably take what they have to say with a pinch of salt.
About if there's a vagina epidemic? An epidemic of vaginas.
That was too many.
If anything, there is an epidemic of vaginas and of penises because they're all over the world.
50% infection rate.
Yeah.
That'd be more pandemic, wouldn't it?
Anyway, so there's an epidemic.
Especially because we're talking about all of them, right?
What if there's an epidemic? What if there's an epidemic that infects vaginas? Who do you trust, the gynecologist or the epidemic guy?
Well, it depends what question
epidemiologist.
You're asking.
Well, sure. Okay. Well, right. That was a boring answer.
Oh, it depends on the question. No, seriously. I know you're joking, but like this does provide a good, it does provide a good learning experience. It depends what question you're asking. Mm. If you're asking about how the disease affects vaginas, then you talk to the vagina doctor. If you're asking
how the disease spreads,
if you're talking about the spread of the disease and the impact of it in that sense, the epidemiologist is probably going to know more about it. But
he had a good answer. I'm furious.
That's my job, buddy.
You're right. I trust you on everything now.
No! No, and this is what bothers me as well, that people come to me and say, hey, Corey, can you explain my very specific disease, please? Or I'm autistic. Can you tell me more about autism? Yes, I can do that. But what I am doing is reading a bunch of stuff and then telling you the stuff that I've read and in some cases trying to simplify this stuff so that it is more easy for other people to understand. Only because I have been taught to some degree read scientific papers, like not to the degree of someone that has like a master's or a PhD.
Like Hank Green.
Sure. Master's, yes, not PhD, to be clear. no, that sounds like I'm really like,
whoa,
I'm really like,
dunking on Hank
having
Green
a
there,
go
actually.
At him. Like, no. But
he's not even got a PhD.
I don't have a PhD.
What's he doing on TikTok?
No, so my
you
point
should
is
reply,
that, like,
go through, when anyone tags Hank Green, you need to reply. He doesn't even have a PhD.
No, I will make a bot to do that. No. but my point is that, like, I have a slightly above average ability than the average person to read a scientific paper because I had to do that sometimes, right? And I can use that to then help other people understand some things that might be a bit above their head, or they might find too daunting.
Mm.
Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that I'm infallible. That doesn't mean that I know more than many other people. Like, I don't, and I am very fallible, and I don't know any of this stuff. I just read papers that collect data and then say that data on a podcast, right? Like, I could very easily be wrong about stuff, and often I am, and we try to correct that. But looking to one person for the source of all of your information, bad idea. But back to love languages.
Yeah, love languages.
So my question for this episode today is it scientific?
No.
And what I'm going to do, you're jumping the gun here.
The priest has a PhD.
So what I'm going to do is go over two papers that I read on this topic specifically, and there's not many studies done on this topic in general. In 2020, there were only six professional journals and one in an undergrad journal.
Wow.
Yeah, not very many. So the first paper I'm going to be talking about is Speaking the Language of Relational Maintenance, a validity test of Chapman's 1992 Five Love Languages. Have we actually spoken about what the love languages are, what they mean?
Yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah, we've touched on the titles.
Okay, well, we can go into that a little bit more deeply before we go into this paper, right? Okay. I think it'd be helpful. So, as Luke said earlier, there's quality time, physical touch, acts of service, giving and receiving gifts, and words of affirmation. So what Chapman talks about in his book is that couples, all couples, everyone in the world has a love tank. And you need to keep that love tank full in order to have a healthy relationship.
Yes.
And the way that you fill up that love tank is through communicating with someone in their preferred love language. People usually have like one or two preferred love languages that they prefer over the others, and they will tend to use those love languages with their partner because that's the way that they want to be communicated with, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
So quality time is like doing activities together, right? It could be doing activities together, or it could just be sitting together, like just spending time with each other, basically. Physical touch could be anything from like hugging to sex, acts of service. It's like, if I do the dishes for you, that's kind of like an act of service, right? Little things, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Like that. And they don't need to be massive things. They could be little things. They could be big things. Anything. Like, I'll tidy your bedroom for you. Yeah. That sort of thing. Giving and receiving gifts. So people tend to think that the sort of giving and receiving gifts can be sort of selfish and all that stuff. It doesn't need to be like big gifts. It could. You find a seashell on the beach and you give that because it's nice.
Yeah.
Right? It doesn't.
As long as the person values the seashell.
Well, they value the gift.
But
no. They value.
They value any gift.
They value that you have thought of them and given them a nice little gift.
A material.
Okay.
So they don't necessarily value any. Like you could find a bit of a broken glass.
Gave Rebecca a PlayStation game, she probably wouldn't be like, woo.
But she might appreciate that you thought of her.
Yeah, but the point is that.
I think the fact that I gave her a PlayStation game demonstrates that I didn't think about her very much.
Yeah, but you've got to understand that the gift demonstrates that you have thought about them and what they might enjoy.
Yeah.
It
doesn't, because it's a PlayStation game and Rebecca definitely wouldn't play a PlayStation.
Yeah, but I'm not saying it's absolutely any gift.
Yeah,
it's just that the gift doesn't need to have a monetary. Okay. It's not the monetary it's the thought that counts.
The thought to get a gift.
Yeah, the thought to get a gift that you might enjoy in some little way.
Okay.
Right?
Yeah.
And then words of affirmation. It doesn't need to be like, I love you, you're the best, but just like sort of like nice little, it doesn't need to be like, you're the best, you're great, all of that sort of stuff. It could just be little things like, I love you here and there, you know? Or you just look positive little statements throughout the day, things like that, right? So that's what these sort of love languages are. As I said, there's a love tank. You fill that up with speaking the correct love language. And if the love tank gets empty, then the marriage can be on the rocks. It's specifically kind of about marriage, right? So do you understand what this sort of theory is about?
So it's called a language, but it's more like little behaviors that people do. Engage in or like want to have done to them.
Yeah, sure.
That symbolize affection.
Yeah,
kind of.
And yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Ways of showing that you love someone.
Yeah.
And I kind of think that that's kind of why he describes it as a language to people, because it's like, well, you can try and show someone that you love them.
Yeah.
But if you're showing them using your love language and that doesn't match up with theirs, then they're not going to understand that you're trying to show that you love them, right?
Yeah.
So, for example, if you two were in a relationship, for example, your love language is quality time. And so that's the way that you automatically sort of try to show your love with Luke by spending quality time with Luke.
This is really good quality time.
But Luke's love language is sort of gifts. And you don't get Luke any little gifts or anything.
Buy me more jewelry. Have some AirPods.
Thank you very much.
And so Luke feels as though you're not showing him love because you're not giving gifts. Luke doesn't spend enough time with you, and so you feel like you're not being loved because he's not spending enough time with you. You're both you're both showing that you love each other, just not in ways that either of you can understand.
Yeah.
Or like understand necessarily the best, right? That's the theory with Chapman, right? I'm not saying this is how people are. This is Chapman's idea. That is, I need to be absolutely clear on this. This is what Chapman says. This is not me saying this is how people absolutely are. So this first paper was published in 2006. It is called Speaking the Language of Relational Maintenance, a Validity Test of Chapman's 1992, The Five Love Languages. It's by Nicole Egbert and Denise Polk. Or Polk. Polk. I don't know how to pronounce that name. By Nicole and Denise. And it's in Communication Research Reports, obviously, like I said, 2006. There's a few great quotes from this paper. I will give them to you now. As popular books and academic research have often been at cross purposes, the goal of this project is to test the factor structure of items derived from Chapman's typology and then to test the construct validity of the new measure by comparing it to established empirical measures of related constructs. Basically, because there are sort of popular self-help books, and there's also academic research, and those two things don't necessarily overlap, it can be difficult to try and sort of reconcile those, because popular self-help books can be unscientific. For example, this book, The Five Love Languages, is inherently unscientific. It doesn't use a scientific method or anything. It just it is basically just Chapman saying, I've worked with people a lot, this is what I've noticed, right? It's not, there's no rigid scientific structure behind that. It's, you can't even necessarily say that it's qualitative. It's based on sort of qualitative research, because there is no inherent structure behind it. It's just a guy looking at his notes and being like, this is what I think.
I've noticed a thing or two.
But could you design a study whereby you have relationships that are not doing very well, and then you figure out the love language, and then you try and get those people, I'll encourage those people to do that more often, and then see if the relationship improves. Would that become scientific?
Sure, yeah. So that would be then testing this out. And that's actually one of the things that are suggested by scientists studying this, but it hasn't been done yet. So what you're talking about is like sort of longitudinal study, wherein you you test how people are over time with love languages, in the context of love languages. There's a number of ways you could do it. So that way that you've sort of offered would be a really solid way of seeing whether, like, of actually validating whether doing this helps or not. But it seems that it, like, from the data that we have, I say the data that we've got, from what we know, it seems to help. It really resonated with people, right? It's a massively well-selling book. So on some level, at least, we could say that people felt as though it helped them. Whether the actual sort of information or ideas in the book are valid, or like sort of valid scientifically, it's kind of another question. But it does help people in some way, seemingly, right?
Mm.
But yeah, no, you absolutely could do that. We've just not done it yet. As I said, there's not been many studies on this. So what this is saying is essentially, because academic research and popular sort of books are very different things, and one of them sort of relies on the scientific method and the other one less so, it is, and they have different intentions, right? Academic research seeks to sort of find truth through the scientific method, whereas those sort of popular books seek to find some kind of truth through experience and advice based on that, rather than finding like sort of the sort of scientific truth. If that makes
sense. But of course, it can also resonate with you whilst being entirely untrue.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and that's why they're at cross purposes. So you've hit the nail on the head there. And so the goal of this is to basically take the five factors, the five love languages that Chapman has presented, and see if they can fit the framework of already established empirical, based on sort of studies and experiments, evidence, measures of related constructs. So basically taking Chapman's ideas and seeing if they match up with what we have actually studied.
Mm.
So there's another quote as well. So incorporating and testing popular press ideas through research serves several valuable functions. A, providing empirical check of intuitive ideas that have found favor with the public. B, forcing researchers to keep current with mass-mediated messages that affect how people view relationships. And C, enhancing the validity of relational measurement instruments. So what that means is that it's valuable for three reasons. One, to make sure that, like, you know, what's going on in the popular culture is true. So just because it resonates with people doesn't mean that it's true. Let's just check to make sure that it is true. Basically, that sort of thing that you were saying, like,
yeah,
you can resonate. It can resonate with you, but it could be like, you know,
not true.
Yeah. So testing that. Second one, making sure that researchers know what is going on, because all too often in science, scientists can be very out of touch with the current sort of, I guess, the zeitgeist, what people are talking about, and where the sort of public consciousness is. It's kind of what this show is about sometimes bringing people closer to the scientists, because sometimes it's very difficult to get the scientist to move closer to the sort of general public, if that makes sense. And then the third one is just making sure that the measurements that we have in science are valid, or, you know, as good as they can be. It provides a way to sort of test those. Yeah?
Yeah.
One thing that I think about this is, I suppose, at the very least, what it does is it introduces you to the idea that just because you have to be very careful when you say this, because it can sound gaslighty, which I'm not intending it to, but like, you can come to a conclusion based on your upbringing, your beliefs around love, your beliefs around how your partner should behave, and based on their behavior, come to the conclusion that they don't love you. Mm-hmm. And actually, it might just be that you are coming to the conclusion that they don't love you, and actually they do, and they might be either, in this case, communicating it in a way that you aren't, that doesn't resonate with your beliefs around love, your beliefs around relationship. It might be that actually the specifics of, like, there are five love languages, there are these ones and these, that might be not true. But what might be true is, like, well, your partner might love you and it just might not be resonating with some beliefs you have around love and relationships. Mm-hmm. And they might actually still love you. And that's quite reassuring. And if you can understand and believe that, then your relationship might just get better.
Yeah.
Especially if you both understand and believe
it. Yeah. I think that really this is about communication. So this paper talks about something called relational maintenance, and it says that Chapman's writing seems to fit descriptions of this in literature. Not necessarily a one-to-one, obviously, and not in the sense that he's read the literature and is trying to simplify it, because I'm pretty sure he hasn't read any scientific literature on that topic whatsoever. Instead, it's the sense that he's using the word love to refer to a concept he spotted independently of the literature. So he, in his sort of counseling of people, spotted this thing, and he referred to it as, he used his own terminology for it, love languages, love tank, and that has been independently noticed by scientists, and they've studied it. There's just sort of almost not exactly.
Yeah.
See, this is right. Why I'm trying to be clear. What I'm saying, it's not a one-to-one.
There's an analog.
Yeah, this, to some degree. Like, what I'm saying is that he hasn't gone off and made up a concept that is entirely off the rails.
Yeah.
He has noticed something, and he has described it in his own way, and there may be some aspects of it that aren't correct, but there may be some aspects of it that correlate somewhat with the present research.
Yeah. What is that? What is that thing that's in the scientific literature? Please.
Let's get to
it. I invite you to answer that question. For the listeners, Corey.
I've got a suggestion for the next segment, notes. Actually.
So basically what I'm saying is that it happens that he's not the first to think of this concept. In fact, some of these parts of this concept have been written about somewhat extensively in scientific papers. So obviously this paper asks two questions. Did Chapman's five love languages form distinct and cohesive factors? And the second question, what is the relationship between Chapman's five love languages and more established measures of relational maintenance? So essentially, throughout this paper, they relate Chapman's five love languages to a measure of relational maintenance. It's Canary and Stafford's 1992 five category typology for relational maintenance. Now, there are different. There are five different parts to this. First, assurances that provide partners with information about their importance, such as stressing relational commitment. So that's similar to words of affirmation, obviously. The second is openness, and that's about talking about relational feelings directly. And so they've related openness to when Chapman talks about making requests instead of demands, because that's another part of the book. It's not one of necessarily the five love languages, but it is something that Chapman brings up in his book. Third, positivity. Now that's making efforts to keep interactions enjoyable, and Chapman describes this as a need to make positive comments, so he brings that up as well. And then the fourth is sharing tasks, and that obviously lines up with sort of the quality time, and Chapman does talk about
and also kind of potentially an act of service as well.
Yeah, if you
share a task, you have gifted half the task.
Exactly.
Oh, yeah, true.
Exactly. Yeah. And then the fifth one is social networks, which correlates to Chapman's quality time by, like, so the sort of social network thing is sharing common friends, and common like sort of people, like sort of friend relationships. So Chapman suggests that a good way to spend quality time together is to bring in other members of the family and other friends to spend quality time together with those friends, so that you've got that sort of, you know, that going on. And so those are the kind of ways that they have kind of correlated them together. And there are some similarities and overlaps there. But Chapman says, and this is where there are some differences, Chapman says that all of this sort of behavior is intentional and strategic. So in terms of using a love languages, that is intentional strategic behavior in order to show love. So I will give you, like, I can give you a small gift because I want to show you that I love you. Whereas some people in literature have slightly different claims. Where they say it's more a sort of, it's a thing that you just kind of do. It's not necessarily an intentional strategic thing. It is just the way that you interact. Yes. And also Chapman stresses that you would you want to focus on a preferred love language, whilst the literature kind of talks more about all categories being expected by partners. And I guess Chapman doesn't necessarily refute that. What Chapman kind of says, I think, is more that, like, there are love languages that are preferred, and those are the ones where you focus on those, and that's how you show your love. That's how you fill that love tank.
Yeah.
But the literature is more talking about all of these being important ways of maintaining a relationship.
I mean, Chapman's data set is also potentially skewed by the fact that he's a marriage counselor. So yeah. he's only meeting people whose love tank is empty.
Yeah.
So, true.
And they're all Christians.
And yeah. So it might be like, okay, you need to focus on one because you're going down. So yeah. Like, what's the worst one? Whereas actually healthy relationship management might be a bit of all of them.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, yeah. I think that it's kind of how we were talking about the Myers-Briggs before. So with the Myers-Briggs type indicator, the way that it's messed up is that those four ways of, like, sort of defining what a person is, those four categories, that doesn't mean that those are the thing that you're best at. They're just the thing that you the way that you prefer to engage with situations. You can be, so for example, like, if I'm an ENFP, I could be better at being introverted than someone who is like an INFP. It's just that they prefer to be introverted, I prefer to be extroverted, but I'm also very good at introverted behavior. Much better than they are, right? Like, I can, like, better is not necessarily the best word, but you know what I mean? Like, I could be much more adept at doing both of those things than someone else, but I could still end up as being E because that's my preferred method. So Chapman talked about preferred. It doesn't necessarily mean the only or best way. It just means the way, one of the ones that you prefer to do. And like you say, if your love tank is empty, it's the quickest way to fill it, right?
Out of interest, do any of you guys feel like you have a love language?
Oh, we would all technically have love languages, and we're going to take that test. In fact, you can find the test over on our Patreon.
Yes.
Taking the love language test.
Okay.
Yeah.
Great.
I say that as though we've done it. We've not done it yet.
I'm going to learn how to love you guys.
I'm going to
learn how to love you guys.
I'll learn how to love you too, Luke.
Didn't say I want to. I said I'm going to. I don't have any choice. You're inflicting this test upon me.
Whether I like it or not.
It's a secret test that I planned, yes.
I learned how to love you guys, and then we're not going to do any of it.
You're going to specifically do the other one.
Do the opposite. I'm going to avoid those things.
So the researchers took 110 married couples.
Did they take them?
Sorry.
On a date.
Funny. they gathered 110 married people or couples, not necessarily married or coupled students. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So people that were in a relationship. They could be married, they could not be. Of greater than 2 months. And enrolled, they were all enrolled in a basic speech course, and then they gave them an anonymous survey. The majority of participants were female and Caucasian, and there were other ethnic groups, African-American, Asian-American, so the different sort of percentages for these. 64% were female, and 88% were Caucasian. 7.4% were African American, 0.9% were Asian American, and 3.7% were other. Most were between the ages of 18 to 22, but some went up to 23 to 30. That was just under 10%, and 30 to 40 made up about 2%, and over 40 years was just under 1%. So the relationships were usually between 2 to 6 months. Were from between 2 to 6 months, that was 15%. But most of them, I think, were between 6 months to 2 years at 47%. And then you had 2.5 years and over 5 years at about 32 and then 4% respectively. So Obviously, there are problems with this right off the bat. The cohort is made up entirely of Sokolda students, and that's a limitation of the study. And they say it in the study itself. Traditional college students are highly invested in romantic relationships. This sample limits our analysis because they have less relational experience, different relational expectations, and their existing relationships tend to be less developed than the general populations. So they took the results and tested to see whether that sort of five-factor model they worked on worked well. So the five love languages worked well. Or if any of the factors could be combined. So they combined words of affirmation and quality time into one category to see if that made a difference. And also then combined gifts and touch to make a three-factor model at sort of gifts and then, like, you know, physical contact to see if a three-factor model fit better. And they found that the five-factor model fit best.
Oh, great.
Yes.
Yeah. That's encouraging.
Yeah, it doesn't necessarily mean it's perfect.
Is it the same five factors?
Yeah, so yeah. It's those five factors. That what that means there is not that the five-factor model is perfect. It just means that those five factors are, from their data, are distinct enough from each other that you can't combine them and make it
fit better. Yes.
Okay. Right? So all that means is that the factors themselves are distinct. Whether that predicts for better relationships...
Yeah.
That's the jury still out on that. This one is only testing to see whether those five factors are distinct factors and not... Because we spoke... If you're confused about this, please go back and listen to the personality test episode, because we kind of discussed this there, where you need to figure out whether you could combine these things and whether, like, are we actually testing for these things, or are we splitting them up unnecessarily, right?
And it also doesn't mean there isn't a sixth factor or a seventh factor.
Absolutely, yeah. And so basically what they found is that there may be some validity to Chapman's model, despite the fact that they couldn't create a measurement instrument from it. But with a larger sample, it might be possible. So if they basically did the study with more people, they might find that it is possible to build an instrument that could sort of predict from that. So what this means is that I think it's quite clear here that Chapman's model kind of has some level of validity. It's not scientific by any means, but it's not completely rubbish, right? Like, the idea that people can sort of the idea that there are, like, different ways that people like interacting with their partners makes sense. And this is all sort of intuitive stuff that we would expect to see science backing up. It's just when we get to the hard specifics of it can be difficult, yeah. Right? So the second paper is called Using Chapman's Five Love Languages Theory to Predict Love and Relationship Satisfaction. That's by Jennifer L. Hughes and Abigail A. Camden. It was published in 2020 in the Sci... Is it Chai? Is that Greek letter? I can't remember how to pronounce it.
Sci.
No. That's Sci is fine. It's the C-H-I one. I know what it looks like. Chi, that's it. Is it Chi?
Chi, well, C-H-I or Q-I is Chi, which is like the life force thing. I don't know whether that's the same thing as the letter.
The one that looks like an X.
Not sure.
I can't remember how to pronounce it. It doesn't hugely matter. It's a Journal of Psychological Research. So it looks into whether perception that a partner is using a preferred love language results in higher love and relationship satisfaction. What do you think?
Slightly.
Slightly?
Extremely.
Extremely. Somewhere, I mean...
Somewhere in the middle of slightly and moderately. Extremely.
Basically what it's asking is that can you predict satisfaction from knowing a partner's perception of how well love languages are used? And that word is really important. Perception is really important there. Mm-hmm. So it actually differs from other studies on this because it uses the scale that Chapman developed in 2015. So he made a scale that you can do online. I think that's the one that we're going to do ourselves to see what your love language is. And other studies had not used this scale. They developed their own scales.
Mm.
And other studies looking to see whether that sort of these scales and whether partners were actually performing these things predicted satisfaction did actually show that it didn't predict anything. But there have been, basically people say that sometimes, as I said, that the problems with those studies was that, one, they didn't use Chapman's model. They made their own model. That could be why their results are so, don't confirm it.
Yeah.
And second, there are other, they used college students for some of them as well. And, you know, there is another thing as well that was an issue. I think it was, the way that they were actually testing satisfaction. So Chapman talks about love. Right, this being love, and they were looking at something slightly different in the relationship satisfaction. So Chapman doesn't necessarily state that it would predict for that. He says it will predict for loving your partner.
Mm-hmm.
And so to basically not test Chapman's, basically the criticisms with those other studies that don't sort of confirm Chapman's stuff is that, well, you're not really testing Chapman's theories or testing Chapman's sort of ideas on their own sort of playing field.
You know,
you're testing them by different sort of, you're testing them by things that they never really necessarily claim to be, which could be a problem. But I'm not saying that those studies are inherently wrong or bad and these studies are inherently good. It's, the jury's out. I don't know. Okay. So this study took 981 participants. So it was 520 cisgender women, 461 cisgender men involved in heterosexual. That was 346 women and 293 men. That works. Lesbian, 174 women, and gay male, 168 men relationships. And they all lived in the United States. And there were also 9 participants who marked themselves as other and wrote transgender without specifying what gender they were. And if they put agender, they weren't kept in the data because they were looking for people in heterosexual and gay relationships. They also then got rid of anyone that said they were bi, pan, demi, asexual, questioning, queer, fluid, or prefer not to answer.
That's hell.
Because they're not gay.
Chuck
relatable.
Them out.
Get rid of them. All of them.
No.
Make up your mind.
Stay. If you do that, I swear, I promise you, 10% of our audience on Spotify is non-binary.
Really? 10, do you know that?
Wow.
Or 10%.
Wow.
Wait, is it 10% or 1?
Wow.
Either way, it's more than it should be.
Now that is what I
not
call
more than it should be, but like more than it should be. More than it should be based on a demographic. Based on the No. Oh, I'm keeping that in. It's more than it should be if we're basing it purely on the demographics of the world. And
it's not a representative
sample. Being a one-to-one. It's absolutely
heavily skewed.
If 10% are non-binary, think about how many of the rest of them are trans and don't fall under non-binary on Spotify.
Oh, no.
Wow, yeah.
Unbelievable, right?
Well, we're rolling hello, with the LGBT. Hello.
Yeah, right? Like, if that's the T, think about the L, G, and B. So many. Oh. If you're straight,
there's no one straight listening to this show.
Let us know in the comments if you're straight. Good to know.
The real minority.
Yeah, you're a minority here for sure.
So the participants ranged in age from 18 to over 65. Most participants were around the ages of 25 to 34. That's 37.9%. And I say most, obviously, like the highest percentage of the sort of the groups was 25 to 34. That was just under 40%. Age 24 was just under 25%. And then 35 to 44 was 17%. And then the rest, 10, 7.5 and 2.1% sort of respectively for 45 to 54, 55 to 64 and over 65. And 16 participants didn't list their age. There's the sort of racial breakdown. They're mostly white, obviously, about just under 8% Hispanic, just over 7% Black, 7% Asian, just under 3% multiracial, under 2% Native American, and 1.1% other. 4 people did not list their race, and most of them had attended college and had a bachelor's degree or some graduate degree. And they all lived with their partners. 45.6% were married, and 5 people didn't answer the question about being married, and 17% of the participants had children, with over half of them living with their parents, as in with over half of the children living with the parents.
Right, I was going to say, weird sample.
I know, right? What a weird sample. We're married, but we live with our parents. No, the kids
we have
lived,
children.
The kids lived with their parents, the parents being the ones that were involved in the study. So they gave them some online quizzes. One on love, which was using Sternberg's triangular love scale. Then to test the partner's perceived use of love language, they basically gave the participants Chapman's 1992 definitions of the 5 love languages. And then they were asked, when you think about your relationship with your partner, how well does your partner do using the following categories? Words of affirmation, quality time, receiving gifts, acts of service, and physical touch. Luke, I ask you, when you think about your relationship with your partner, how well does your partner do using the following categories? Words of affirmation, quality time, receiving gifts, acts of service, and physical touch. You can use a 5-point scale from poorly to extremely well.
Beck is the best, man. We don't do massive amounts of gifts, but the rest is great.
So a 1 on the gifts and 5 stars.
No, we just don't. No.
You've said it. 1 on the gifts. And 5
we just
on everything
don't do
else.
Gifts. I don't do gifts either. It's not like I'm showering her in gifts and she's giving me.
There's no need for gifts.
Well, I've already asked Rebecca how she'd rate you, and she said 1
star on everything.
Other than gifts, too many gifts.
Other than gifts, too many. 2 stars on gifts. You need to knock that down a stone.
Yeah. Well, actually, she said that the one on quality time was the fact that you spent too much time with her. She wants
a zero.
Yeah.
Just to break
just
the scale.
Stay away.
Yeah. Please. Lord. Get away.
Overbearing.
So, to obviously test their love languages, they use, as I've said, Chapman's 2015 sort of survey for it.
Daily.
What, you test your love language daily?
To each other.
Yeah, wake up in the morning. Is that what you do before
first
breakfast?
First thing you do.
Well, test your love languages? Nah.
Every day, just to check. Keep a graph of them.
Just to make sure.
See how it's going? What's the trajectory, down or up?
You realize that testing your love languages isn't testing how well your partner... It's testing to see what your preferred love languages are.
Yeah, just got to see if they change.
Okay.
Give them to Rebecca. I give the results to Rebecca and go, this is how you treat me today, by the way. This is how I'm feeling.
See, I feel like this is probably why Rebecca's listed you so
lowly on everything. No, that
no
wasn't quality time.
The only gift he gives me is every morning a list of his love languages. I don't know why.
And that's the most services he engages in.
He's not one explained exercise. What he wants me to do. He's just given me the list.
No.
Work it out. Do your own research.
And then to test the relationship satisfaction, they use something called the relationship assessment scale. And there's a lot of data here, but essentially what they found was that generally, it does predict for satisfaction, which is pretty interesting.
But it's correlation, not necessarily causation. If you increase the emphasis on the love language, does the relationship satisfaction go up, or is it that that behavior is a manifestation of already being in a good relationship?
Well, this is the issue, right? This is why they suggest doing, in this paper specifically, they suggest doing longitudinal studies, so studies over time on the topic of love languages, because there's only so much information you can garner out of this. And another issue with this is that I think that, like, if people know about love languages, I think that could itself just affect the results, right? Like, if you think that a partner is trying to speak to you in your love language, you're probably gonna feel like that's a way where you'll think,
better.
Oh, they're trying, and so that's good.
Yeah.
I'll get to this in a second, but like, it helps. It seems to help, but whether the actual concept of love languages itself is what is helping, or whether it's the framework for giving people a way to understand that their partner is trying to show their affection for them. I don't know. I think that's a difficult thing to look into. So essentially what they find with this is that, it does seem to predict for that. Like if someone says that their partner does well in performing those love languages, then it does predict for greater relationship satisfaction. Interestingly though, there were some weird things with men and women. So women reported greater love than men when it came to, I think, physical touch. So women reported greater love than men when their preferred love language was acts of service, and they felt like their partner was providing acts of service as well. And they also reported greater love than men when their love language was physical touch, and they felt like their partner was using physical touch well. And apparently that ties in with research that's been done in the past, where women and men are equally likely to show affection but express love differently. And married women apparently express love by having fewer negative interactions, and the married men show love by initiating sex and sharing leisure activities and doing household work with their partners. And it could be, apparently, this is a quote, could be that the women in heterosexual relationships in our sample were responding to the men showing love by initiating sex and doing household work with their partners, and therefore felt more love. But obviously they say that more research needs to be done to look into this. I just think it's really interesting that throughout most of them, there are no differences between gay people and straight people, and there are those are the only real differences they find between men and women, which I think is interesting.
In gay people, do both men, on average, have the same love language then?
Doesn't say that on there.
Okay.
Oh, no. So it's not about having the same love language.
You said about the showing, initiating sex or that kind of thing, yeah.
So I said, so that's not about love languages. So that is in a different study where they found that initiating sex, which then they would correlate to physical touch. So in the previous study, this was just saying that in heterosexual relationships, women respond to men showing love by initiating sex and doing household work with their partners. That study isn't really related to love languages. That's just a study on that topic itself. Cool. Yeah. And it's not, this isn't like, you can't really take from that study, oh, this is women's preferred love language.
No.
Yeah. No. Yeah. It's not it's not how really how that works. Yeah. It's just they're kind of different things. Yeah, I don't think there was a huge predictor between sort of like sexuality for like your love language or how you respond to them. And I'm not super sure about the, because it's just there's a lot of data. I'm not super sure about how the actual love language predicts for gender. I don't think there are huge differences, but there may be. You can check the paper yourself. It's in the description. But the main takeaway is that they found that there was some predictive element to it. You could predict based on whether someone perceived their partner performing those speaking in their love language, and whether that actually predicted for them having more love for their partner.
Mm.
And they what's sort of the issue that they have with Chapman scale is that Chapman scale is is forced option. So I'll read this as a quote. Chapman scale is forced option scale with 30 possible points divided among the five love languages, and his intent is to have participants score higher on one of the subscales than the others. So essentially what they're saying here is that because Chapman wants you to score higher on one, on one of the options than all of the others, so that you can figure out what your preferred love language is, that then results in you not necessarily... Like, it's not necessarily the best result, because you could score super high on all of them, but one be 1 point higher than the rest, and that will make it so that your preferred love language is, say, acts of service. Whereas someone whose love language is, words of affirmation could score way lower than you on words of affirmation, but still their preferred love language is words of affirmation. And what they want to study on that is to see whether that means that if you've got, like, a higher score on in general, whether like that means you're more responsive to that like love language in general. So like if you've got both people whose sort of love language is words of affirmation, if someone scores way higher than someone else, but it's still both their preferred love language, does the person who scored higher respond more to? We don't know. There haven't been studies on that yet. But yeah, it's so Chapman's scoring method is just not necessarily the most scientific, the best. Basically he wants you to find your love, your preferred love language, but it's not good for understanding how strongly you feel those or like comparing you to others. Similarly to what I was saying about the personality test, where I could be better at like sort of thinking and feeling or whatever, but I still get like F, even though just because I prefer it. Yeah. You know,
this is the same problem, but a similar problem with the Myers-Briggs personality test is that if you are like 51% I and 49% E, you get put into an arbitrary binary category, and it's like, and you literally can do the quiz again and just answer slightly agree instead of strongly agree, and now you're a totally different person.
Exactly.
Apparently.
Yeah. It's not perfect, and to be fair, it's not meant to be perfect. It's just, this is the issue. Like, basically, they're questioning whether it's additive and whether you could increase love and satisfaction by looking at like people that sort of have a score higher on the tests. But those aren't the only studies, and there are a number that have not confirmed Chapman's claims, like I've said, but there might be methodological flaws in those, and we've already pointed out some of the limitations of the ones that we've spoken about today, and there are limitations, and there are always limitations with studies. What I'm saying here is that I don't want you to believe that love languages are scientific, right? That's not the takeaway from this. The jury is still out on that. I don't know. I can't say to you whether they're scientific or not. They seem to match up in some cases with the science, but that doesn't mean that they're inherently scientific. What I think is that they can be a useful guide rather than a rule. Basically, if you understand your partner's needs and make an effort to meet those, that's important in any relationship. And the love languages, that just gives you a framework to do that.
Options.
I think generally Chapman was speaking to a lot of people who were Christian, who went to their pastor as a marriage counselor, who lived in North Carolina. And I think a big part of that is not communicating effectively with your partner. And what Chapman did is provided a framework to allow them to communicate effectively. Yeah. I think generally people don't communicate effectively whatsoever because they don't understand each other and they refuse to, or don't understand, how, not refuse to so much as they don't understand how to communicate effectively. Yeah. And really, if you communicate effectively, that's going to solve a lot of problems in relationships, right? The love languages thing could be like, hey, how do you want me to show that I love you? How do you want me to do that?
And also making you aware of how the other person is showing them, showing you that they love you,
yeah,
which you might have been
Oblivious to.
Oblivious yeah. to, yeah. Yeah,
absolutely. So it's not like inherently scientific, but it's not all nonsense. I think generally the takeaway from this is that if love languages help you, that's fine. It's good. Doesn't like, and there could be some scientific validity to it in that these different categories are distinct and people do like people, they are distinct ways of showing love.
And they correlate to satisfaction.
They to can. A certain extent. That one right. study showed that they could potentially correlate to satisfaction.
It. I'm doing it again.
I know it's tough. It's tough. this is so my point. Hard.
Where's Hank Green? Hank Green?
No. My takeaway for you for you listening and for you two from this is that whether or not love languages are scientific, they are useful to people, and that in itself holds some value. However, trying to make the claim that they are inherently scientific or they will save you or anything like that, it's a bit dangerous. Try them. If they work and help you, good. That's all that matters. Don't say they're science. Should we do a quick fire quiz?
Yes.
Dun, 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 dun. Love edition.
So the quick fire quiz is the same as always. I will ask one question. It's one question to the two of you. The first person to buzz in with the correct answer after finishing the question wins. What do they win, Jemp?
Words of affirmation.
Oh. From Corey. Okay. You have to say that'd be nice.
Oh, God. Luke, what's your buzzer?
Ooh.
You're going to make it really hard. I hope you don't win. Jemp, what's your buzzer?
Ooh la la.
So the question is... When was Gary Chapman's first book on love languages published?
Ooh la la.
Jemp.
1992.
Well done, Jemp.
Yay!
That was the word of affirmation.
Oh, well
cherish
done.
It.
That's not oh. a word of affirmation. You not affirmed anything other than that he got the answer right.
I said well done. That
it's two
was
words.
You did it well.
Mm.
That's it. I'm affirming that you have done a good job. You have done it well.
Thank you. Keep going.
Okay.
No. I've been so nice, I'm going to take it back.
You said it a few times.
I'm going to have to say so many. I'm going to have to say the same number of mean things to you just to bring it back.
No.
Bad job, Jemp.
No.
Your Pokeball teacher is dumb.
No.
I actually quite like it. Thank anyway, you. I think that's it for today, isn't it?
Yep.
So before we go, we would like to thank all of our patrons with a very special thank you to executive producer Rosa Rodriguez.
Hey.
And thank you for watching. You can find full references for this episode in the description. Subscribe for new episodes every Sunday. And why not leave us a nice wee comment? You can support the pod at patreon.com/SciGuys, or you can find a contact us at SciGuysPod on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, here on YouTube, and at SciGuys on TikTok too, or at SciGuys.co.uk. Or you can send us an email at SciGuysPod@gmail.com.
That's SciGuysPod@gmail.com.
SciGuysPod@gmail.com.
You can follow me at NotCory everywhere.
You can follow me at Jamkin everywhere.
You can follow me at Luke Cutforth everywhere.
And goodbye.
Goodbye.
Have a happy Valentine's Day.
Yay.
Oh, yeah.